AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. I hope each and every one of you had a blessed Christmas and a happy new year. Before the holidays, we'd been covering the ideal of Second Oswald in and around Dallas leading up to the assassination. It's part of this series that we're covering that I'm calling The Hills to Die On regarding the JFK assassination. A hill to die on refers to a cause, belief, or position someone is so strongly committed to that they are willing to fight for it to the very end, even if it means facing significant consequences or defeat. Essentially, it's an issue someone considers so important they are prepared to stand their ground no matter what. One of the biggest hills that I choose to die on in this case is the fact that we know with absolute certainty that there was someone impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks or possibly months leading up to the assassination. There is not a single doubt in my mind that someone was impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald and setting up a narrative for him for some time before the assassination. I found during my research that many of the sightings of a second Oswald was seen by multiple witnesses. This was not just some random person who resembled Oswald. In most instances, witnesses reported that the man they identified as Lee Harvey Oswald provided specific details about Oswald's life, such as his family and his past, that made it clear he wanted people to believe he was Oswald, even if he wasn't the real one. The question I have is, why was someone doing this, and who was doing this? Think about it for a minute. These impersonations were done for a reason. These took a lot of time, effort, and money. This was not someone out doing it for fun. And why would you impersonate Lee Harvey Oswald anyway? This person that wanted people to think he was Oswald was seen at the gun range several times, a furniture store, a car dealership, applying for a job at a couple of radio stations around the Dallas area. He also spoke with Laura Cottrell at the Texas Employment Commission, trying to convince her that he was Lee Harvey Oswald when she knew it wasn't the real Lee Oswald because she had spoken to him on several occasions. This person also applied for a job at the Hill Machinery Company and put down the name Oswald on his application, and his Marine service was also listed on the form. In some recent episodes, we looked at impersonations of Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks and months before the assassination. We heard about sightings of two Oswalds in Dallas just a couple days before the assassination, on a city bus, at the Dobbs House restaurant, and then we heard the incredible and sad story of Ralph Leon Yates, as he picked up the Oswald double on Wednesday, November 20th, giving him a ride to the corner of Elm and Houston, which happens to be the location of the Texas School Book Depository building. These are just a few places that the person was seen impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald, when we know for a fact that the real Lee Harvey Oswald was present at other places during these times. If you missed it, you must go back and listen to this incredible episode number 88. In episode 89, we looked at the sightings of the Oswald double on the day of the assassination, possibly in Dealey Plaza, the site of the J.D. Tippit shooting, the Texas Theater, and in an El Chico parking lot at about 2 p.m. on the day of the assassination, after the real Lee Harvey Oswald had already been arrested and in police custody. Conveniently, this El Chico parking lot where the second Oswald was last seen by T.F. White in Dallas was only about a block away from the Texas Theater. Today, we save the best for last in our final Second Oswald Hill to Die On episode, an incredible bombshell that was dropped about the second Oswald by a former U.S. Air Force Sergeant, Robert Vinson. He claimed to have witnessed an interesting event on the afternoon of the JFK assassination. This story first broke in 1993, when Robert Vinson shared his story with Wichita, Kansas, KAKE-TV anchorman Larry Hatterberg. Vincent told Hatteberg in 1993 the same thing he told me in January of 1998 when I interviewed him. I had just visited my hero and mentor, Penn Jones Jr., at a nursing home in Alvarado, Texas. He died a few weeks later. I then drove to Wichita to interview Sergeant Vincent, and what follows in this episode is what he shared with me on that day in early January of 1998. He said that on the day of President Kennedy's assassination, he was on an airplane that made an unusual flight change and landed in Dallas. What happened next has fueled those who believe we haven't been told the truth about the Kennedy assassination for years. In 2003, a Wichita lawyer, James Johnston, and a writer, John Rowe, did more research into Mr. Vincent's story and followed it up with a book. Their book was titled Flight from Dallas, New Evidence of the CIA Involvement in the Murder of President John F. Kennedy. It not only contained Vincent's story, but their research added new elements to an already incredible story. A later account placed Vincent's story in the context of the events immediately after the assassination in James Douglas's 2008 book titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Mattered. As a JFK assassination researcher and writer, I'm constantly asked if I believe Robert Vincent's story is true. Over the years, there's nothing about his story that we've been able to disprove. His story, to the best of our ability, checks out. Mr. Vincent passed away in 2009, but the interest in his story continues. Here's an old news report talking about the book A Flight from Dallas when it was released in 2003.
It details a plane ride taken by former Air Force Sergeant Robert Vincent, and by sheer accident, he was placed on a plane November 22, 1963, that he believes belonged to the CIA and was connected to the Kennedy assassination. Vincent's story.
My fellow Americans.
On November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was hoping to make new friends in Dallas. On November 22nd, Staff Sergeant Robert Vincent was at Andrews Air Force Base in Washington. He was hoping to hop a military flight back to his home base in Colorado.
The clerk told me, he said, you see that C-54 out there? I said, yeah. He said, it's going to Denver. Why don't you go get on it?
At about that same time, President Kennedy was getting ready for a Dallas motorcade. But Air Force Sergeant Bob Vinson wasn't concerned with that. He just wanted to get back to his unit. On board the plane, he thought it odd that the pilot or co-pilot didn't speak to him. There was also no crew chief on board, and at that time, almost all Air Force flights had a crew chief. Plus, the tail designation was odd. It wasn't a normal Air Force insignia. As Vinson winged his way towards Denver, the presidential motorcade in Dallas was underway.
At 12:29... The pilot came on the loudspeaker and said,
President John Kennedy was shot and killed.
And he did a complete 180, headed south.
Dallas was their destination. Not an airport, but a dirt strip which may have been an interstate road under construction.
We came in real low, and we came in pretty hot, or pretty fast. We landed, never did shut the engines off. Pretty soon, the co-pilot came back, unlatched the door, did not say anything to me. Two people boarded the aircraft. They were in beige-type coveralls. They walked to the front of it and sat down right behind the cockpit. They didn't speak to me or say anything to me.
Nor did the two men acknowledge the pilot or co-pilot. They just sat there. One was Cuban or Latino. The other was Caucasian. They were only on the ground for 5 minutes. The plane then landed at an Air Force base in New Mexico, a base that was on full alert.
They just jumped out whenever they landed. They just bailed out. As far as I was concerned, it was the most unusual flight I'd ever been on.
Over the next few months, Vincent was transferred to a new squadron, his background checked meticulously. His new assignment was a CIA unit. Both he and his wife were sworn to secrecy.
I feel that there is a connection. My wife feels there's a connection.
And those unusual markings on the tail of the aircraft that Vincent took to Dallas, he later found they indicated the plane belonged to the CIA. The book, Flight from Dallas, is based on a 1993 Hatterberg's People interview with former Wichitan Robert Vinson. This book details what its authors say is new evidence of CIA involvement in the murder of President John F. Kennedy. The book follows a 10-year investigation by Wichita attorney James Johnston and reporter John Rowe. Now, with the publication of the book, Flight from Dallas, both John Rowe and James Johnston believe they've now uncovered a small piece of the Kennedy assassination puzzle. Since the book's publication in the past few weeks, the authors have been surprised at the interest.
I really didn't expect it to develop so rapidly.
Suddenly, it's a big deal, and everybody's very excited about it.
Now, what the authors found backs up Vinson's story. So whatever you believe, the book is fascinating reading.
Mr. Vinson is one of the most credible people, one of the most credible witnesses I've ever encountered.
Those who have read it, who are not conspiracy theorists, end up saying, yeah. Yeah, I believe this guy. But God, if I believe him, then the Warren Commission is wrong.
That was just a quick overview of Sergeant Vinson's story. Here's the rest of the story, and it adds to the speculation that Vinson not only saw the second Oswald on the afternoon of November 22, 1963, soon after T.F. White did, but he actually witnessed the Oswald double escaping from Dallas in a CIA plane. Sergeant Vinson was already on the CIA getaway plane when the second Oswald boarded it. Vinson also got off the plane at the same CIA base as the Oswald double did, a few minutes after him. Robert Vinson is a unique witness to the CIA secret movement of the Oswald double out of Dallas on the afternoon of the assassination. But how did Vinson end up on that plane to begin with? Well, here's the rest of that story. On November 20, 1963, Sergeant Robert Vinson took a trip to Washington, D.C. from Colorado Springs, where he was stationed at Ant Air Force Base on the staff of NORAD. The 34-year-old sergeant had decided for the first time in his 16-year military career to go over his superiors' heads. His purpose in traveling to Washington was to ask why he had not received an overdue promotion. Vinson's rise in rank had been delayed in spite of him having received outstanding job evaluations at NORAD, where he served as administrative supervisor of the electronics division and held a crypto security clearance. Sergeant Vinson was known by his NORAD commanders as a mild-mannered subordinate who could be counted on to not raise any uncomfortable questions. But after discussing at length the problem of his stalled promotion with his wife Roberta, Robert Vinson decided now was the time to depart from his usual pattern of compliance. On Thursday, November 21st, in a basement office of the Capitol building, Sergeant Vinson met with a Colonel Chapman, who served as a liaison officer between Congress and the Pentagon. While he looked over Vinson's papers, Chapman engaged in a phone conversation Vinson would not forget. Colonel Chapman told the person on the other end of the line, quote, he would highly recommend that the president not go to Dallas, Texas on Friday, because there had been something reported, end quote. Colonel Chapman said the president should cancel his Dallas trip, even though an advanced group of congressmen whom Chapman was coordinating with had already left the Capitol. Vinson did not hear what the quote something was that moved Colonel Chapman to urge the last second cancellation of President Kennedy's Dallas trip. Colonel Chapman referred Sergeant Vinson's promotion question to an office at the Pentagon. A personnel officer there scanned Vinson's records. The officer was puzzled as to why he had not been promoted. He assured Sergeant Vinson that their office would look into the situation. The next day, November 22nd, Vinson took a bus to Andrews Air Force Base. He planned to hitch a ride home on the first available flight going to Colorado Springs or its vicinity. When an airman at the check-in counter told him there was nothing scheduled that day going his way, Vinson still wrote his name and serial number on the check-in sheet. He said he was going for breakfast in the cafeteria and asked the airman to, quote, let him know if anything should come through that he don't have a notice on, end quote. About 15 minutes later, a loudspeaker paged him. He left his breakfast sitting on the table, grabbed his bag, and ran for a plane that was pointed out by the airman, who said it was about to depart for Lowry Air Force Base in Denver. The plane down the runway that Vincent climbed aboard was a propeller-driven C-54, a large cargo plane. Unlike all the other planes Vincent had hitched a ride on, the C-54 bore no military markings or serial numbers. Its only identification was on its tail, a rust-bound graphic of an egg-shaped Earth crossed by white grid marks. The plane's door was open. When Vincent got in the C-54, he found it empty. He took a seat over the right wing. Through the windows, he could see two men in olive drab coveralls walking underneath the plane. Their coveralls bore no markings. In a minute, the two men got on the plane. They walked right past Vincent without saying a word. The men then closed the cockpit door, and the engine started up, and the plane took off. Looking out the window at the runway disappearing beneath him, Vincent reflected on the flight's strange beginning. Whenever he had hitched a ride before with the Air Force, the crew chief had always asked him to sign the manifest or log. This flight didn't even have a chief crew, much less a manifest, nor did the pilot or co-pilot, if that's what the second man in the cockpit was, give him the usual friendly greeting. His reception had been total silence from the two men now flying the C-54 due west. At a location Vincent thought was somewhere over Nebraska, he suddenly heard an unemotional voice say over the intercom, quote, "The president has been shot at 12:29 p.m., end quote. Which is strange because the president was shot at 12:30 and word didn't get out to the others until several minutes later. It's almost as if they knew in advance. Immediately after the unemotional announcement, the plane banked into a sharp left turn. It began heading south. About 3:30 p.m. Central Time, Vincent saw on the horizon the skyline of a city he was familiar with, Dallas, Texas. The plane turned and came in over Dallas in a southeast direction. It landed abruptly in a rough, sandy area alongside the Trinity River. It was not a runway. Vincent thought it looked like a road under construction. Dust blew up everywhere as a C-54 taxied around in a U-turn and came to a stop. The engines kept running and never shut off. Through the window, Vincent saw a tool shed of the type used by a highway construction crew, perhaps 4 by 6 feet in size in a large, open, sandy area. Low cliffs stood at a distance. Across the river to the north was the Dallas skyline. Two men were running towards the plane from a Jeep, which then backed out of Vincent's sight. One of the plane's pilots came back and unlatched the passenger door. The two men came aboard. Vincent watched as the men passed his seat without looking or speaking to him. They were wearing off-white beige coveralls, the type used by highway workers. They carried nothing. The two men sat down behind the cockpit. They said nothing to the man who let them on the plane or to each other. To Vincent, it was obvious that they were following orders, which must have included keeping silent about what they were doing. The taller of the two men, who was 6 foot to 6'1", weighing about 180 to 190 pounds, looked Latino. Vincent thought he was Cuban. The shorter man, 5'8 to 5'9 inches tall, weighed about 150 to 160 pounds. He was Caucasian. When Vincent watched the television events from Dallas later that weekend, he recognized Lee Harvey Oswald as identical to the shorter man that he had seen board the plane. Without ever having stopped its engines, the C-54 took off from the sandy area in the northwest direction. Carrying the man who looked identical to Lee Harvey Oswald, the plane soon left Dallas, and the jailed, about to be killed real Lee Harvey Oswald far behind. A little after dusk, the C-54 landed on the runway. Going by what he was told at Andrews, Robert Vincent continued to think the plane's destination was Lowry Air Force Base in Denver. As soon as the C-54's engines were shut off, the two men in the cockpit emerged quickly. They rushed past Vincent out the door of the plane without saying a word. The two passengers from Dallas hastened after them. Vincent was left alone in the aircraft, just as he had been in the beginning. Quote, "This was very strange, very, very strange," end quote, Vincent said years later in our interview. Quote, "I couldn't understand why we were in such a rush. They just bailed out," end quote. Robert Vincent descended from the plane into the gathering darkness. There was no one in sight. Nothing looked familiar. Across the runway, he could see a building with lights in it. Inside, he found a lone air policeman on duty. Vincent said, "Hi, can you tell me where I am?" The air policeman said, "You're at Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico." Vincent then said, quote, "I thought I was going to Denver, Colorado. How can I get to downtown to catch a bus?" End quote. The air policeman told him he could not go anywhere because the base was on alert. No one could come in or go out. Vincent thought that was strange because the C-54 had just come in. How had their plane managed to enter a base that no one was allowed to enter? It didn't occur to him that the arrival of their plane could have been the reason for the base's closure to everyone else. That would explain why Vincent found the runway area deserted. At least one of the C-54 passengers was not supposed to be seen by anyone. But Vincent had seen him and had even flown out of Dallas with him, though he didn't know the significance of the man whom he had seen. The air policeman said that there was nothing for Vincent to do except take a seat in the waiting room until the alert was lifted. After a couple hours, the air policeman told him that the alert was over and gave him directions to a bus stop. By the next morning, Saturday, November 23rd, Robert Vincent was at home in Colorado Springs, telling his wife Roberta the story of the strange flight. Although they didn't understand what lay behind it all, they both felt it could be dangerous. They agreed not to discuss it with anyone else. That night, while watching the TV coverage from Dallas, Robert shook his head in disbelief. He said to Roberta, quote, "That guy looks just like the guy who was on the airplane with me that we picked up near the Trinity River in Dallas," end quote. "Are you nuts?" she said. "It couldn't be him. He's in jail." Vincent would then say, quote, "I swear that's a smaller guy who got on the plane," end quote. Roberta would say, "Well, keep quiet about it." After Lee Harvey Oswald was murdered the following day, Robert Vincent kept quiet for 30 years about the guy he saw get on the plane in Dallas. However, his silence could not erase the name and serial number he had given the airman at the Andrews check-in counter the morning of November 22nd. No doubt the two men who got on that plane in Dallas and the two in the cockpit were thoroughly debriefed. They would have referred to the other members of their team, a man as silently obedient to the plan as they had been, who was on the C-54 before any of them got on and until after they got off. One can imagine the debriefer's shock. What other man? The subsequent discovery that it was Air Force Sergeant Robert Vincent who was the unauthorized passenger in the flight from Dallas led the Vincent suspected to further developments in their lives. In the spring of 1964, after Vincent was promoted to technical sergeant, a friend told Robert and Roberta that their neighbors were being questioned by the FBI about what kind of people the Vincents were and what they talked about. Not long after, Robert was ordered by his commanding officer to sign a new secrecy agreement. Roberta was also asked to fill out a personal history statement and to sign a secrecy agreement herself. That was the first time she was ever required to do so as an Air Force wife. On November 25, 1964, Robert Vincent received orders to go to Washington, D.C. and report to a telephone number, quote, "in conjunction with a special project," end quote. When he arrived in D.C. and phoned the number, he received instruction that resulted in spending 5 days at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. The CIA put him through a series of psychological and physical tests. At their conclusion, he was interviewed in a conference room by a half-circle of men in semi-darkness. They asked Vincent to work for them. He refused, saying he wanted to retire from the Air Force and take a job in Colorado Springs. The CIA men offered him a lucrative contract, which he again refused. They finally let him go, but as it turned out, they had not let him go at all. 3 months later, Robert Vincent was again ordered to report to a telephone number for the CIA, this time in Las Vegas, Nevada. The difference was he was no longer being asked to work for the CIA. He was told to work for the CIA. The Air Force had reassigned him to a top-secret CIA project, the Blackbird SR-71 spy plane, at an airbase hidden in the Nellis Mountains, 40 miles northwest of Las Vegas. In more recent years, after the base was closed especially because of radioactive contamination from the Nevada test site, this former CIA testing area was identified as Site 51, or as we know it, Area 51. On his new assignment, Vincent would soon learn that the CIA's project out of Area 51 included experimental aircraft shaped like saucers. The same was true at the CIA's other base at Roswell, New Mexico, where the C-54 carrying the second Oswald landed. Both Area 51 and Roswell were home to the, quote, "flying saucers" that people saw periodically in the area. They, in fact, came not from outer space, but from the CIA, which encouraged the flying saucer reports as a convenient cover story for the U.S. experimental aircraft. For the final year and a half of his Air Force enlistment, Vincent served as administrative supervisor for the base supply of the CIA's SR-71 Blackbird spy plane project at Area 51. It was obvious to Vincent that he was not so uniquely qualified for this position that the CIA would for that reason alone pluck him out of NORAD staff in Colorado Springs only 18 months before his retirement and insert him into the Nevada project. The agency had other reasons for asking the Air Force to reassign him. He and Roberta agreed the CIA was keeping both of them under close observation while paying Vincent off for his continuing silence with the CIA's monthly cash payments as a bonus to his Air Force salary. Nothing explicit, however, was ever said to him about his inadvertent presence on the flight from Dallas. While Robert Vincent was working at Area 51, he saw a C-54 like the one that flew the second Oswald out of Dallas. On its tail was the same rust-brown graphic of an egg-shaped Earth, crossed by white grid marks that he had seen on the C-54 he boarded at Andrews. An Air Force sergeant at Area 51 confirmed the source of the plane he was looking at as, quote, CIA. Robert Vinson's CIA employment ceased with his retirement from the Air Force on October 1, 1966. Although the CIA had paid him well to keep silent, he and Roberta felt as if they had been freed from a plush prison. Out of fear for his life and concern for his military retirement benefits, Vincent maintained his silence during the 20 years he worked in Wichita, Kansas, first as an accountant, then as an administrative assistant and supervisor in the Wichita Public Works Department. In 1976, when he asked a lawyer friend in Wichita if he should reveal a secret, the lawyer said, quote, "Don't tell a soul, for your own safety," end quote. Yet Vincent's conscience continued to push him towards speaking out on what he knew. After Congress passed the JFK Records Act in 1992, mandating the disclosure of government records on the assassination, Vincent consulted with his member of Congress. Representative Dan Glickman of Wichita said to his relief that the new law freed him from his secrecy agreement when it came to the assassination information. On November 23, 1993, Robert Vincent told the story of his flight from Dallas to news anchor Larry Hatterberg on Wichita's KAKETV Channel 10 News. Viewers gave, quote, "an incredible response" to Vincent's story. One of those responding initially to Vincent was the Wichita civil liberties lawyer James Johnston, who had studied the Kennedy assassination. Johnston volunteered his legal assistance to Vincent to help bring his testimony to the public and government's attention. Vincent then offered to testify before the Assassination Record Review Board created by the JFK Act, but was never called to do so. In 2003, James Johnston and journalist John Rowe co-authored their book, Flight from Dallas, describing Robert Vincent's experience in detail. On a Dallas map sent to him by Johnston, Vincent identified the C-54's landing area as the Trinity River floodplain, just south of downtown Dallas. The particular location he marked out as the landing strip, between Sedez Street Viaduct and the Corinth Street Viaduct, was 4,463 feet long. James Johnston found the C-54 expert to consult, retired Air Force Major William Hendricks, who flew the C-54 on over 100 missions during the Berlin airlift. In response to Johnston's query on what the C-54 could do, Hendricks wrote, quote, "It is my personal opinion that a C-54 could have easily landed and taken off at the Trinity floodplain area," end quote. In yet another colossal CIA blunder, Robert Vincent's presence on the second Oswald's flight from Dallas had enabled us to see the planning for the Oak Cliff follow-up to the assassination. First, in Dealey Plaza, came the killing of JFK by snipers firing from the grassy knoll in the Texas School Book Depository. Then in Oak Cliff, the scenario continued, with Oswald's escape in a taxi, while the second Oswald was driven into the same area in a Rambler station wagon, by the man Roger Craig described as, quote, "a husky-looking Latin," corresponding to Robert Vincent's description of the Oswald companion who got on the C-54, standing 6 foot to 6 foot one, weighing 180 to 190 pounds, whom Vincent, like Craig, said looked Latino, probably Cuban. Officer J.D. Tippett was then shot to death by a man who witnesses said looked just like Lee Harvey Oswald. After Tippett's murder and Oswald's capture, in a shell game featuring the Oswald lookalike, he and his Cuban-looking companion flew out of the Oak Cliff area on a CIA plane. The C-54's landing strip by the Trinity River was on the perimeter of Oak Cliff, where the CIA plane taxied in a half circle and paused to pick up the second Oswald and his Cuban-looking partner was 1.3 miles from the El Chico's parking lot. The man like Oswald, whom T.F. White saw sitting in a CIA-connected car on El Chico's lot at 2 p.m., was a five-minute drive from the point where the CIA plane would meet him at 3:30 p.m. He had plenty of time to reconnect with his handler, change into highway workers' coveralls, and rendezvous with the C-54, while his more visible counterpart went to jail, and 2 days later to his death. Robert Vincent has said that since November 22, 1963, quote, "every time I'd see an article on the assassination, I stop and wonder if I had the answer to this puzzle. Could this small piece of information fit into the larger picture to help us learn what happened?" End quote. Thanks to pieces of information presented by Mayor Wes Wise, auto mechanic T.F. White, concession stand operator Butch Burroughs, hobby shop owner Bernard Hare, innocent bystander and moviegoer Mr. Al Pike, and Air Force Sergeant Robert Vincent, we now have a larger picture of the way in which two men played the role of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas on the afternoon of November 22, 1963. The interlocking testimonies of Wise, White, Burroughs, Hare, Pike, and Vincent have given us a backstage view of the double Oswald drama directed by the CIA. Next week on The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination, we will hear from Robert G. Vinson himself in a November 2nd, 1996 interview he did. In this rare interview, you will hear from Mr. Vinson himself about the events of November 22nd, 1963 and what he witnessed that day. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon. Or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the 61st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.